So this particular talk has come out of a sort of a period of study I've been going through, where I've been actually picking particular suttas or collections of suttas in some cases, and then building a talk around that particular sutta. It's a way to make myself study and at the same time expand my understanding of the Buddha's teachings. So this particular talk is based on what's called the Samadhiti Sutta. Samadhiti means basically right view, or the teachings, and sutta is teaching. So this is the teaching or teachings on right view. And it's from this book here called the Majjhima Nikaya, which is a collection of sutta, the teachings of the Buddha. Majjhima just means middle length. So this isn't the really short ones and it isn't the really long ones. It's the ones that are sort of in between. It's just a way to divide them up, right? otherwise, I mean, it's a shelf of books that's like, you know, 4 feet wide to get all of the books. So this is one of the two main ones I use. And the interesting thing about this sutta, most of these suttas are teachings of the Buddha, right? So these are direct recordings of things he taught. This particular sutta, however, is actually not. This is one of his chief disciples, Sariputta. And so you'll see that from time to time in the sutta where a different voice will arise, but it's really the same voice being repeated in repeating the Buddha's teachings, but it's a different, slightly different style almost, I think, when you come across these teachings of other people than the Buddha and the Sutta. Anyhow, so I wanted to mention that. And I wanted to start by reading a poem, which I think leads us into the whole idea of right view. And this is a poem by Ryokan. Ryokan was a 17th century Zen monk in Japan. And this is from his book, One Robe, One Bowl. Buddha is your mind, and the way goes nowhere. Don't look for anything but this. If you point your cart north when you want to go south, how will you arrive? This is a very clear pointing to the idea of right view. I mean, right view, I mean, it could be called wholesome view. I think skillful view is also a very useful translation. It's like we have to not only have a view, but a skillful one, one that leads us in the right direction. You know, if not, we end up, you know, pointing our cart south when we want to go north. Well, we're not going to get where we're headed, that's for sure. And so it's that's the whole idea. I mean, right view is the first step on the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's the very beginnings of the Buddha's teachings on the process. And so this particular sutta is an explanation of what the Buddha meant when he said right view. Another translation of that, by the way, is right understanding or wholesome understanding or skillful understanding. We're trying to you have to understand this stuff. It's not just something we sort of do blindly. That it requires that we understand. So this I'll start here with the first section. The wholesome is called the wholesome and the unwholesome. When, friends, a noble disciple understands the wholesome, the unwholesome and the root of the unwholesome, the wholesome and the root of the wholesome, in that way he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what, friends, is the unwholesome? What is the root of the unwholesome? What is the wholesome? What is the root of the wholesome? Killing living beings is unwholesome. Taking what is not given is unwholesome. Misconduct in sensual pleasure is unwholesome. False speech is unwholesome. Malicious speech is unwholesome. harsh speech is unwholesome. Gossip is unwholesome. Covetousness is unwholesome. Ill will is unwholesome. Wrong view is unwholesome. This is called the unwholesome. And what is the root of unwholesome? Greed is the root of the unwholesome. Hate is the root of the unwholesome. Delusion is the root of the unwholesome. This is called the root of the unwholesome. Sounds pretty grim, huh? This little section, these three, two verses here, are often taught as the 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. And I've seen people give like a whole retreat on just this. And the importance of this and why the Buddha begins here is he's saying basically, pay attention to how you live your life in the world. You know, don't think that I can go meditate and sort of ignore all this other stuff. At the same time, and this is really important, don't use this sort of teaching to beat yourself up, which is where we can go pretty easily. Oh, I mean, I'm so full of all these unwholesome things. Oh, I'm so bad. And that doesn't go anywhere either. That's not very useful. That's unwholesome, as a matter of fact. It's not right view. And it's interesting, by the way, that one of the 10 things here, one of the unwholesome things is wrong view. That wrong view in and of itself is unwholesome. So we need to sort of see how we lead our lives. And the understanding part is all of these things, only this long list, this list of 10 things, if you look at your life over a period of time, or look at, you know, your life as a whole, these are things we all experience. These are things that we've all done at some time. We've all gossiped at some time, or spoken a little untruth, or behaved improperly in some way. And it's not like there's anything, doesn't make you bad. It just means you're human. And so we need to understand that this is like part of being a human being. And then we want to understand the root. Where does these unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind come from? What's the root? What causes them? And sure enough, our old friends, the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. This is what causes us to act in unwholesome. We get caught wanting something, and we sort of know we shouldn't be doing this, but we really want to do it. Or we're trying to push something away. We don't want something. And we know, well, I shouldn't really push that away. I should deal with that. But we try and push it. Or we just space out. We're so deluded, we don't know what's going on. These are the roots, causes of unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. And so this practice of meditation, this practice that the Buddha taught, is basically learning how to recognize these things, see them as they are, to understand that they exist, that they're part of us, be okay with that, accept that that's truth. Yeah, sometimes I'm like this. And then see if we can chop off the roots, get rid of the roots, the source of these things. And then we can change. Then we can move towards more of a wholesome view and living, acting and living in a wholesome way. But it starts at how we live in the world, our basic everyday life. I mean, we can't ignore that. Then he goes on and he says,
good friends, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands nutriment, the origin of nutriment, the cessation of nutriment, and the way leading to the cessation of nutriment. In that way, he is one of right view and has arrived at the true Dhamma. And what is nutriment? What is the origin of nutriment? What is the cessation of nutriment? What is the way leading to the cessation of nutriment? So this question is an interesting question, right? He says, what is the origin? What is the cessation? What is the way leading to the cessation? This is every step of the way, this is the questions the Buddha is asking us to think about. To understand, this is where these things come from. This is how we can make them stop. This is what leads the cessation of them. And this is the key to right understanding. It's like asking yourself questions. It's not like intellectually almost. It's like you're sort of caught in the middle of doing something and you go, oh my God, look what I'm doing. It's skillful at that point to go, just drop the little question into your mind. How did I get here? How did this happen? It's not like and it's not like you're gonna intellectually figure it out. But just ask that little question, drop that question into the mind and see what arises. And sometimes that's when a moment of insight arises. Like, oh, I see how I got here. I see the origin of this. The idea, so the word nutriment itself, is like nutriment is like how something we eat. It's like a food, right? It's how something is fed. And what the Buddha is trying to get at here is that we feed our sense of being, of separateness, of being someone separate from everything else. And it's that sense of separateness that leads us to greed, hatred, and delusion. This feeding is caused by craving. When we stop craving, we stop feeding this idea of being separate, which leads us to greed, hatred, and delusion. It's all very sequential. Why do we do this? Why do we feed this idea of separateness? Because somehow or other we keep believing that the nutriment, this idea of separateness, will fill us. I mean, that's what we want. We eat, we want nutriment to get full. That somehow will give us a sense of being complete. If I take in this nutriment, it'll fill me up and I'll be complete. But it doesn't work. And I want to mention something at this point. When I was reading this, I didn't really understand this, to be honest with you. This is part of my study thing. What is this nutriment stuff? And I found this amazing Dharma talk on Dharma Seed. If you go into dharmaseed.org and you type in nutriment in the search, there's 3 Dharma talks. That's it, on nutriment. And one of them was a whole Dharma talk on this verse, essentially. And it was by a monk whose name I now forget, which is terrible. And when he said something really interesting to me that made me understand this in a way. You know, this idea that somehow we think this nutriment will fill us. We keep getting fooled into believing that. And how that really doesn't work. When we want something, when we are caught in craving, at the time we actually get that thing, it's wonderful. And let's be honest. You know, I wanted that ice cream cone and then I got it and it was great. That first lick was just like bliss. Yeah. So there's this time of craving and then we get what we're craving and at that moment, it feels great. It seems, yeah, this is going to fill me.
And that's why we keep believing it's going to work. That somehow or other, if we just get the right thing, whether that's like the right teaching or the right ice cream or the right who knows, that it's going to fill us. But what this Dharma talk said was, look at it this way. There's this period before you get the thing, this period of craving, which is typically pretty unpleasant. It's like, I want it and I don't have it yet. And it's like, And then you get the thing and there's this, this is nice, I got this thing. And then it's gone. It's like everything, it rises, it's there for a while, it's gone. And then there's another period of not having. So you don't have when you're craving, you have, and then you don't have again. So for every period of having something, you've got two periods guaranteed when you don't have. How is this a successful strategy for feeling happy? When two-thirds of the time, you don't got what you want. It doesn't make sense. On a purely intellectual level, this even doesn't make sense. I don't have it, I have it, I don't have it. When I have it, it's nice. When I don't have it, it's not nice. This doesn't work. And that's why the whole idea of nutriment, of feeding these desires, is unsuccessful as a way of thinking. It's not right view. The idea that somehow we can satisfy all our desires just isn't wholesome view, because it doesn't work. It doesn't actually make us happy. It makes us more unhappy, as a matter of fact, because we keep having these periods when we don't have what we want. Most more time not having than having. It makes us, instead of feeling making us feel complete, it makes us feel less satisfied. It makes us feel grumpy sometimes, even, like for me anyway. Then the Buddha goes on. When a friend, a noble disciple, understands suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, in that way he is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma. It's the Four Noble Truths, right? So the Buddha is saying, when we understand the Four Noble Truths, not intellectually. This isn't like an intellectual exercise. It's somehow feeling at some experiential level, knowing the truth of the Four Noble Truths, that they really are truths, is what we have to do. I want to read a little something from Joseph Goldstein here. This is a section from his book Mindfulness called Right View. What a surprise. This is that would be appropriate. The first and critically important step on the Noble Eightfold Path is right view, or right understanding. Sometimes when we hear the term right view, we may associate it with an orthodox dogma that we need to subscribe to and that we can then perhaps rebel against. But it becomes easier to understand its meaning if we see that right view, that the right view the Buddha enumerated is right in terms of understanding the noble truths. It is the view that helps us realize them for ourselves. Keep in mind that none of the Buddha's teachings requires blind belief. The invitation is always to come and see, to investigate and examine for ourselves whether the teachings accord with reality and are conducive to our welfare and happiness. Right view is the important first step on the path because it sets the direction. No matter how long or difficult our journey may be, if we're heading in the right direction and we keep going on, we'll certainly reach the goal. If we don't know the right direction, then even with strong aspiration and effort, we might wander for a long time and never reach our destination. The Buddha said, that just as the dawn is the forerunner and precursor of the rising sun, so is right view the forerunner and precursor of the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths.
What he's pointing at here is this is a practice. That understanding the Four Noble Truths isn't something we can just read a book and intellectually take in or listen to a Dharma talk about it and take it in. It's something we have to, through our practice, reach a deeper sort of understanding of what it really means when the Buddha says, you know, that there is suffering in the world. What does that really mean? You know, and that could be a whole Dharma talk, just that. Then he talks about the origin of suffering. How does this suffering arise in our lives? And then the cessation, so how do we make it stop? And then here's the way, the method, the process, the Fourth Noble Truth, right? Here's the process by which we can actually end our suffering. And we have to take this in on some deeply internal way. That's right view. When we have that understanding, when we take that in on some deep level, that right understanding is what then motivates us to practice. Then I want to read one other thing here. This is from Ajahn Sumedho, from his book called The Mind in the Way. The first of the eight factors in the path is right view, samadhiti, which develops from having seen and experienced cessation. To have right view requires that we be very mindful all the time. We must know that everything arises and passes away and is not self. And this must be a direct experience and insight. Right view is based upon direct, insightful knowing, not just thinking and believing in the concept. As long as you don't really know, but just think you know, you will always be in a state of uncertainty and be confused. This is because intellectual knowing is based on symbols alone, not on direct experience of the truth. Can't be more precise than that. And it's, I don't want to make this sound like, oh my God, this is so hard. Because it's, if you didn't have some level of right understanding already, you wouldn't even be here. You'd be watching the Rockies on TV or going to a movie or who knows, watching something probably or listening to something or doing something or hanging out, playing cards or gone to the casino, whatever it is you want to do. I mentioned casinos only because I drove through Black Hawk for the first time a couple of weeks ago and I was stunned by the number of casinos in one place. That, there must have been like 40 of them there. How do 40 casinos keep in business, but I guess they do. Anyhow, so that's the idea of right understanding. And then the rest of this sutta, what the Buddha does, and it took me a while to figure this out, is he takes the 12 steps of codependent arising. But the sutta goes through them backwards. And it took me, like, because I've always, you know, you usually hear them going in one direction, right? And these are going back the other way. And it's like, huh? It was like, I got sort of confused. It took me a while to figure what they were before I started. Oh, that, wait, these are the 12 steps of codependent arising. And then I thought about it a bit, and it was like, oh, wait, this is called codependent arising, right? Codependent arising. If A happens, B will happen. But also,
If B happens, A must have happened. So it's a two-way connection. It has to work in both directions. So whether you go through in the normal way from 1 to 12, or you go from 12 back to 1, they make sense in either direction because they're codependent. They're directly, if A happens, B happens, then B happens, A happens. Must have happened sometime. And so, since he's trying to expand and explain the origin of things and the cessation of things and what leads to the cessation and how to do that, it sort of makes sense to go backwards, in a sense, because you can see how, oh, if you're here, this is how you got here. You can keep seeing the origin as the step before in this 12-step process. So I want to sort of go through some of these steps. And instead of reading another, I've read you about 15 of the 72 verses in this sutta. I don't want to sit here and read. I could sit here tonight and just read you the rest of the sutta, and that would be it. We'd be finished for the night. So instead of doing that, I want to just talk about some of the things in here. And he starts off by talking about suffering, right? He's talking about the Four Noble Truths. And what is the origin of suffering? It is craving, which brings renewal of being, is accompanied by delight and lust, and delights in this and that, that is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for being, and craving for non-being. That is called the origin of suffering. Craving, wanting, either wanting or craving for non-being is not wanting that, thank you very much. But it's this idea that we, in a sense, keep creating this sense of self over and over again, this idea that we're a separate being. Craving for being or non-being is the same as the opposite of that, but it's still a sense of separateness. And what is the cessation of suffering? It is the remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting of that same craving. That is called cessation of suffering. And what is the way leading to the cessation of suffering? It is just this noble eightfold path. And he keeps repeating that sentence for the rest of the sutta. Every time he says, and what's this, how to get this to end? It's the noble eightfold path. He just repeats it over and over and over. The noble eightfold path is the key to right view. In that if we follow that path, if we take up that path, it leads us towards right view. Right view is the first step on the path, but it's also what keeps the whole path together. And as we progress along the path, we get a deeper understanding, which deepens our right view. And you know, we think it's not a straight line. It goes around and around and around and deeper and deeper and deeper. It's like more like a spiral, perhaps. But it's like this line keeps being repeated. When a noble soul has thus understood suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, here he now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view. Then he goes on and he says, well, what caused suffering? Right? We're going, how did we get to suffering? The previous step. When, friends, a noble disciple understands aging and death, the origin of aging and death, the cessation of aging and death, and the way leading to the cessation of aging and death, in that way he is one of right view and has arrived at the true Dhamma. Then, so what causes the arising of death? You'd think that would be, who knows, right? But this is what the Buddha says about that. With the arising of birth, there is the arising of aging and death. Death arises because you're born. Nothing you can do about it, in other words. It's like just what happens. Guaranteed. You know, life is a disease with 100% mortality rate. It's just, that's the way it is. And we need to understand. Here we are back to right understanding, right view. This is something we need to understand, that the fact that we have a human body, the fact that we were born, will lead us inevitably to death. And we have to take that in. This is like, especially in our culture, we try and push that away. I mean, our whole culture is based on, you know, let's do something to make me look younger and feel younger. Like, think of all the advertisements for things that are about making us look younger and feel younger. It's like, I want to do anything but think about this fact. I don't want to do anything but understand this. This is way too depressing to think about this. But it's a fact. Pure and simple. You know? Death arises because you were born. End of discussion. Then he says, how does birth arise? And this is not a birds and a bees talk, so don't worry. With the arising of being, there is an arising of birth. Whenever we have a sense of separate self, we give birth to something that must eventually die, and that death will cause us to suffer. So now we're not talking about this physical body being born and eventually going to die. What we're talking about here is how we constantly, over and over and over and over and over again, give rise to these ideas of me being separate. And they typically have stories around them, right? This is me, Barry, the Dharma teacher, isn't my Dharma talk going to be great tonight? I'm looking for, you know. That's just me being separate, me having this idea of me being a separate being. You know? But it's like we do that all the time. Every time we project into the future, we're creating another being. Every time we think about the past, we're going back to a being we used to be, but it isn't there anymore. We're just creating these beings all the time. And we're giving birth, mentally giving birth over and over and over and over and over again to this sense of I'm separate in this way based on this particular story about me. And that leads to suffering inevitably because whatever that idea is, it's going to end. Like everything arises, it's there for a while, it's gone. So, the death is inevitable of that thing I'm giving birth to, it's going to die. And then I'm going to suffer. Because I like that idea of me being the great Dharma teacher. And, well, maybe I am, maybe I'm not. But one day I will be, and another day I won't be. I won't be able to talk. Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? So, it's when we start seeing that, start understanding how we're constantly giving birth to new ideas of separate selves, new ideas of who we are. That's where how we cause ourselves suffering. Because in giving birth to them, we know they're going to die eventually, and when they die, we suffer. Because we don't like the death part. Then he goes on. Where does this sense of being come from? Why do we keep getting caught in these stories about ourselves, these ideas that we're a separate self? How do we keep getting there? With the arising of clinging, there's the arising of being. When trying to hold on to anything causes us to have a sense of separate self. As soon as you hold on, trying to cling to anything, clinging is the cause of us creating this sense. Because now it's, I cling to this idea of me being this, or me having this, or me not being this, or me being with that person all for the rest of our lives is going to be wonderful. Or whatever that idea is, that mental idea, that physical idea. It's the clinging to, holding on tightly, trying to make that thing permanent, which is what clinging is all about. We're trying to take something that's impermanent, that is going to arise, is going to be there for a while, and then it's going to be gone, and we cling to it, and we try and make it permanent. And that trying to make it permanent creates that sense of being. That's the source of clinging, of that. That sense of being is that clinging to things. A little sub-note here. There are four kinds of clinging. So this is like when the Buddha gets more detailed. Mm. Clinging to sensual pleasures. Clinging to views. Oh, there's the views again. Huh? Clinging to rules and observances. And clinging to the doctrine of self. These are four things we cling to all the time. So it's not just stuff, sensual pleasures. It's mental stuff. Clinging to views, clinging, I suppose this would be clinging to unwholesome views. Clinging to views that lead us astray. You know, because, but even, I suppose, clinging to wholesome views would be dangerous, because even wholesome views, things change. Clinging to rules and observances. This is comes from the time of the Buddha when, you know, the Brahmins controlled everything in North India at the time of the Buddha, and they ran the whole place by rules and observances. You know, there was a rule and observance for everything. Literally, everything that could be done, they had a way of doing it the right way, and only if you were a male Brahmin could you actually do these proper rituals to make things okay. And the Buddha was very strongly speaking against that sort of clinging to those sorts of ideas. Then, well, where does clinging come from? With the arising of craving, there is the arising of clinging. Craving is, like, clinging is like really grasping tightly. Craving is like, that looks nice. Or, don't like that. It's like that initial thought that arises of liking or not liking, wanting, not wanting. So craving is sort of the beginnings of clinging. A craving for something arises, and then if you're not careful, all of a sudden, you know, like, oh, sure would like some of that Boulder Mountain ice cream. And then before you know it, you're in the car driving down 28th Street, pulling into the parking lot. Now you're clinging, which started just as a simple thought. And then you clung to it, and now you're off. There you are, standing in line, because it's a hot night, right? Okay. And then he says, there are six classes of craving. Another list, right? The Buddhism is full of lists. It's great in some ways. There are six classes of craving. Craving for forms, craving for sounds, craving for odors, craving for flavors, craving for tangibles, physical sensations, and craving for mind objects. In other words, the six kinds of craving are based on the six senses. Every one of our senses has a way of creating craving. We can crave for seeing something, tasting something, hearing something, smelling something. And then craving arises from Vedana. Vedana means, rough translation, feeling tone. This is an interesting thing I've only ever seen in the Buddha's teachings. I've never seen this discussed much anyplace else. Basically, whenever anything arises at any of the sense doors, the first thing that happens, the first mental formation that arises after something's arisen at one of the six sense doors, is Vedana. And Vedana has basically only three flavors. pleasant, it's unpleasant, it's neutral. So Vedana, when it's pleasant, leads to I want. Vedana, when it's unpleasant, leads to don't want. Vedana, when it's neutral, is who cares? Space out. Delusion. Let's go find something more exciting. So craving arises because Vedana arises unobserved. That's the key thing here. Vedana is where, in this chain of events, we have some opportunity to cut off the process. Because Vedana is really simple. It's just really, something happens, the first thing that's going to happen is this sense, this mental sense of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's it. It only has those three forms. And if we can detect Vedana as it arises in our practice or in our daily life, if we can see that initial pure reactive process, then we can go, oh, I know where this goes. Pleasant's going to lead me to craving. And just not go there. Choose not to. This is the escape hatch that the Buddha talked about. In some places, there's this talk about the space between Vedana and craving. In that space between Vedana and craving is all of the Dhamma. Everything that you need to know is in that space between Vedana arising and craving or aversion or delusion arising. That little... Now, the problem, of course, is something arises at a sense door, Vedana arises, craving, clinging. You're in clinging after about a second. Boom, 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 boom. So the reason we practice, the meditative form we practice, this idea of sitting still and still in the mind and calming the mind, is that it gives us a chance to see Vedana arising. If we can slow the mind down, if we can still the mind, if we can just tune into the moment-by-moment process, then we can start to see Vedana arising. And then we start to have choice. Well, whether we spin off into the cycle or we stay in that small gap between Vedana and craving and let the next thing arise and the next thing arise. Almost done. Feeling tone arises from contact. In other words, any moment where anything arises at any of the sense doors is called contact. Well, gee, that's pretty much inevitable, isn't it? There's no way out. We can't shut off contact. We can't say, no, I'm going to shut down all my senses and shut down my mind and not ever think, and then I won't have any contact. Wouldn't that be great? No, actually, it'd be like being dead. That's what happens, actually. That's one pretty good description of death, when you have no contact anymore. So no, we can't stop this process. We can't sort of step into the outside. And this is the key understanding in some senses. It's like, this is called being a human being. A human being has these six sense doors that are constantly being bombarded by sense impressions, and then the Vedana arises, and if we don't notice the Vedana, we're caught in this reactive chain that leads to suffering every time. Because A leads to B, this is called codependent arising. One thing inevitably leads to the next. So this is, in some senses, the key understanding of the whole thing. And we can talk about right understanding. It's that you can't avoid this. You can't step aside. You can't pretend it's not there. It's inevitable. It's called having a body and a mind that functions. It just happens. So now what we have to do instead is to understand this and then learn to skillfully work with this process of things arising at our sense doors. That's a pretty good description of the practice. And one, you know, people say, you know, this practice is all about knowing what's arising in the moment. That's exactly what we're saying here. This is about really seeing. And but then we have now what this teaching does, in a sense, is gives us some sort of structure that we can see the process as it unfolds. Even if a lot of the time we don't see the vein, then there we are. At some point in the middle of clinging, we can go, oh, clinging, it's like this. And once we see that, now we can step back a little bit. We don't have to get caught in that whirling sense of being separate again anymore. So it's not like, oh, if we don't see Vedana, that's it, it's over. Any point along the way, we learn to see these things. That's what the practice allows us to do. We learn to see all of these steps as human, as natural, and start to have understanding of them because we see them, we experience them. They're not just theoretical ideas. This is how things are. And that's what, you know, Sariputta is describing how things are in this sutta. And how things are gives us the right view. If we have the right view of how things are, then we're pointing our cart in the direction we want to go. Ah, I see how this works. At least I have some glimmering of it. Now I've got some chance to work with this as opposed to pushing against it all the time. Or ignoring it, which is what we often try and do. Pretend it's not going to be. I'm not going to have those things happen to me. Well, but we do. excuse me. Sometimes, as I often say, poetry speaks to these things much better than I can. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. It's called Mysteries. Yes. Truly, we live with mysteries too marvelous to be understood. How grass can be nourishing in the mouths of lambs. How rivers and stones are forever in allegiance with gravity, while we ourselves dream of rising. How two hands touch and the bonds will never be broken. How people come from delight or the scars of damage to the comfort of a poem. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, look, and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. It's those last two lines that always get me. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, look, and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. That's right understanding in action, I think. Let's just sit for a minute. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings
everywhere.
Thank you all for your kind attention. If you can help put chairs and mats and things away, that would be a big help too.